Maybe your pops was tops. Maybe your father's a bother. If he's angry and mad or an absentee lad, no matter what kind you had, here's fuck you, Dad.
Welcome to another episode of Fuck You Dad, everybody. This one's a little different because my co-host Kenyon is out doing the road, being a road dog, killing shows in New York and Texas, I'm sure. I only got one angry text, so that's good. But this week we have the co-creator of the Lincoln Lodge, where we record every episode. It's Mark Geary. Mark, what's going on, man?
Oh, nothing much. Just sitting in this room looking around going, what needs fixing?
Yeah, I'm sure that happens all the time in your mind, right? Walking up and down here, you just kind of scan the walls, like what's next?
Yeah, just I come in 6 o'clock in the morning a lot of times before my regular job, and I just walk through, like, okay, what shit's broken? What needs improving? I mean, it's just relentless.
A comedy club's got to be really eerie at 6 a.m., right? Because it's still got the lingerings of what happened the night before, but it's not totally washed out, you know?
No, it's area with people in it. At least I'm in complete control.
Oh, that's,
I'm the only
that's
person
true.
Here, and that's important to me.
So, Mark, what part of England are you from?
From slap bang in the middle. So,
okay.
Coventry and Leicester are both sort of 10 miles away from the village that I sort of born and lived
okay.
in. So, you know, England being so tight,
yeah.
you know, it's like I'm 10 miles from Coventry and Leicester and like 25 from Nottingham and Birmingham, that sort of thing.
Okay, so you weren't far from Wolverhampton, where my dad's from, right?
Nope. Used to go to Wolverhampton every Monday.
Oh, yeah?
I used to race motorcycle racing, and then I followed it after I finished it. And Coventry was my team, and Wolverhampton was one of our most like hated rivals.
Right, right.
But because we just wanted to watch the racing, it was Coventry on Saturday, Oxford on Friday, Wolverhampton on Monday.
Awesome. Did you like Wolverhampton, like the city? Because I've been there a couple times as a kid, and gotta say, not thrilled.
I always liked Birmingham people, and it was just weird because my dad hated them.
Yeah,
and I mean, obviously, a Wolverhampton person's gonna say, "I ain't no Brummie."
Yeah,
you know, but
Brummie.
Yeah, I'm no Brummie. Yeah, you know, and like, and I had a lot of stuff going on where, we were racing motorbikes. They were the rivals, so I was there a lot. And I always, the only thing I don't like about Birmingham is some little bastard stole my car in Cradley Heath.
Yeah, there's a lot of theft going on.
Yeah, if it ain't. I had to explain that to someone the other day. I was like, in England, if it ain't nailed down, it's gone in like 10 minutes. So that's the only bad taste I have of the West Midlands, is like having my car stolen and then some little bastard like wrapped it around a lamppost. But anyway, that's got nothing to do with my dad.
Yeah.
Actually, it has, because he was mad because...
Yeah, what happened? So how old were you when your car got stolen?
No, I was driving it. So we went over to Cradley Heath to watch a match.
Right.
Watched the racing, came out of the stadium, we're walking up the street, and we're like, you could tell, me and two of my mates, as our brain, as we approached where the car should be, was going, the fucking car's not here.
Until that's got to be a hell of a thing to process.
It is, because eventually you stand in the space where you know it should be, and we just looked at each other and went, the fucking car's not there, is it?
Yeah.
And then we walked back to the stadium. The car was found, but the little bastard had like burned the clutch out, wrecked the gearbox, and then just drove it into there's a whole story about how we almost got killed by some bikers because the kids that nicked the car had hit one of these bikers earlier in the night. We went to the car to try and start it, like push start.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Then they're like, who drove this car? Blah, 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 blah.
Well, we pushed the car down the street to bump start it. The car starts, and my mate, for whatever reason, was driving it. I was doing something. Anyway, and the brakes had been totally sort of wrecked, the foot brakes. So he pulls the handbrake on to stop the car. There's no other way to stop it.
Oh, man.
The car screeches to a halt. There's all these bikers at the bottom of the hill. They hear the screech, see the car, and just come motoring up the street towards us.
Yeah.
And we had some cops with us who'd met us at the car, and we're like, oh, it's okay, we're with the cops. The cops were the first bastards to turn around and start, like, legging it up the street. Yeah, yeah. So we're all just legging it. These bikers, like, going to kill us, and eventually they catch up with us, and we're like, look, mate, it wasn't us. It hit you. They explain why they were going to kill us, you know. And that was
that's nice of them.
Yeah.
I feel like Americans would have just done it. Like, there's no explanation going on. There's no courtesy. There's just, like, we're going to beat your ass, boy. Yeah.
But, no, we, you know, eventually, like, because we were saying to the cops, you've got to fucking help here.
Yeah.
You know, and eventually everyone sorted out what the hell had transpired.
Well, that's good. I mean, that would have been a really bad day. Car stolen, car wrecked, beat up.
Yeah. They had cassette. It was the 90s, so I had cassette tapes. They'd all been nicked. Yeah, I had a really good cassette tape collection. It was just not good. Anyway, the dad point of it was, my dad, God bless him, had put the engine into that car.
Oh, wow.
By himself, while I, like a total, you know, dickbag young man, just stood and let him do it. And then I was so pissed off about the car that I said to one of the bikers, can you scrap this for me? Because I'm not interested in trying to get it back to Hinckley, where I'm from.
Yeah, that was stupid.
And then my dad was not happy to get back from, I think he was in Hong Kong at the time. And he got back a couple of weeks later and he was like, not happy that I just said scrap the car.
You know
what I mean?
I mean, I've definitely done things like that where you mess something up and you're like, well, just fuck the whole thing. Like, I don't even want to look at it anymore. Yeah. You don't think about, you know.
Yeah.
So the motorcycle racing, like, how young did you start that?
My whole life my entire family is involved in motorcycle racing.
Okay, so everyone's a petrolhead, as you say?
Yeah, right? Yeah. And then I didn't actually start racing until I was about 15, because we just weren't a wealthy family and it needs a bit of money to get into it.
Yeah, because, I mean, and because how many motorcycles would you go through?
I raced a sport called Speedway, and it's actually, for motorcycle racing, it's pretty basic.
Okay.
The engine has no gearbox, bike has no brakes, it's just an engine and a clutch.
The bike has no brakes?
No, but if you saw a race, you'd understand why.
Okay.
It's on like a shale oval, and you couldn't even brake if you wanted to brake, because you're on shale. The back wheel is spinning like crazy, and you're going sideways. If you Google Speedway, you'll see the sport.
Okay,
and
that sounds fucking terrifying.
No, I mean, it was something I was raised around. I was almost But my dad always told me I was almost born at the stadium, because my mom had a bit of fire in her.
Yeah,
and he said she was like 9 months, you know, up the stick at the stadium and screaming her head off in this very heated match and stuff. So I was almost born to it, literally. And then by the time I was about 14, 15, like, we had enough money to just get a... But the bikes are real basic. It's not like, you know, I need six bikes and a team and all that.
You don't need a team or anything
It's the cheapest motorcycle racing you could probably get into.
Okay. Were you ever involved in any, like, big crashes or anything like that?
Yeah, I think the only video I ever uploaded of me doing anything is me crashing heavily in a race and getting stretchered off, because I thought comedians would enjoy it. But so at 15 I started racing, and then that's way too late to start racing. Like, when you start a kid motorcycle racing, you got to start them at 5 or 6 when they're fearless. Because the older you get, the more fear you accumulate.
The more terrible things have happened to you, the more you realize, like, terrible things can happen.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
you know.
So stick a 5-year on a motorbike and go for it, you know.
Yeah, you just have to be a bad parent and kind of hope it works out, you know.
So actually, it's good. There's a lot of discipline. I would highly recommend it. But
I think one of my cousins should actually start doing this, because he's a maniac on a bike, and he's not great at school. So I mean, we've been telling his parents, just get him on a, like,
a motocross bike.
A motocross bike, yeah. And put him on a trail and let him go nuts.
Let him go, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll come back, maybe he won't.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so we were just, like, doing that. I can't even remember why you asked the question. Oh, yeah, so I was raised all around, and eventually I turned semi-pro. Like, it took me a while to get to it.
Yeah.
But I was racing for money. I mean, not a great deal of money. You know, I have friends who went full pro and were, you know, like top 20 in the world type, but I got in good enough to get paid, which is, you know, you're in the top 10%, but I was nowhere near the as good as you need to be to make a living.
Was that was it, like, your dad was pretty pumped about that, the motorcycle racing, like he was all for it?
Yeah, I mean, because he came from a very poor family and he'd wanted to do it.
Yeah.
So this was him at least finally getting a shot at it. So
that's very cool.
It was cool, but it caused a lot of, I'm sure. I mean, when you both want the success, like, I had so many just big bust ups with my dad over the racing side of things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you race in a bike, everyone thinks, oh, it's just simple. You twist the throttle and you go and you do this.
That thing looks terrifying. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I like to think that, you know, because I got to race, you know, for money and all this, and it was a worthwhile of his time, because we did a lot of miles, you know what I mean? Just, you got to practice and do all this stuff. So we spent a lot of time in the car going to and coming back from things.
Okay.
So, you know, a lot of FaceTime with dad that. I think in the end, he actually, when as I was coming towards the end of, like, racing, when I realized, like, I'm not going to be able to do this professionally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of a thing that seeps into your head. I think he was as bummed about it as I was, but we kind of took it out on each other as, like, the disappointment of it. Like,
yeah, I mean, you got to blame somebody, and he's going to blame you, and you're going to blame him, and you know, it eventually, how did he, is that when you started comedy? No,
I'm still in England at this point, so okay. I gave it up when I was, like, 22. I was like, this is too old now. This is too old for this. And then I started racing again. A couple of years later, I really got the itch to race. So we just did some amateur stuff.
Okay.
And my dad loved that as well. So we would go amateur racing on Sunday. And that's just, you know, lower stakes, more fun. There's less pressure. And we, you know, just having got a pro, almost semi-pro status, I could have a lot of success at that.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah, so I did that for a bit. I did that right up until I came to America. Okay. So I came to America when I was like 26. So the bikes was long buried at that point. I mean, I had been racing amateur up until I came in.
Yeah.
So
have you done anything here?
No, I got an itch to have a motorbike. Yeah, so I actually have 7 motorcycles.
Oh my God.
So I got this old Honda. I love old Hondas. So a bloke I was working with, his missus had it, and he said, oh, she's kept it in a garage all these years. And my eyes just lit up when I saw it. I go, I'm in this bastard, you know. And then after a while of riding that, I was looking around for a project, because I'm very, like, engineering oriented. And I thought, what's the one? I've had every bike you can name except Harley Davidsons. I hate them. They're pieces of shit. And I will never touch one. But every other bike you can name, I've had one. And I'd never owned a vintage Italian scooter. Now, I don't know if your dad told you about the whole mod thing and if you've seen the film Quadrophenia, but
no.
Okay, so in the 1980s, there was what they called the mod revival. So when I was at school, kids started becoming mods again.
What is that?
Okay, so a mod was like the kids who were into The Who and The Kinks and all that.
Okay.
And it was a 60s thing, like mods versus rockers. So
I think I understand what you're...
It was like a youth cultish thing in the 60s, right? So there were rockers who were guys who rode around on the big Triumphs and Vincents and stuff.
They
were sort of greasers, you know, leather jacket and stuff.
Yes, that was my dad. He had long green hair and he did mushrooms and he liked Pink Floyd.
Okay.
Maybe that wasn't...
No, I don't think that's a rocker. That's a hippie.
Oh, okay.
All right. A rocker was like in the late 50s, early 60s.
Oh, that's way before his time. Yeah.
Late 50s, early 60s, they had bikes, you know, like Triumphs and Nortons and like British bikes. They had leather jackets and they would just ride around on bikes. Then there was youth culture of like these kids who wore like tight jeans and Italian shoes and like the Fred Perry shirts.
Oh, okay.
And,
like, yeah.
Like a mod. Okay, so like, I'm trying to think of something.
With those bags that strapped over one shoulder kind of thing, like a...
it's a very like, very distinct culture. Like they wore a lot of...
British youth culture has that all the time. Like a chav is really hard to explain to Americans. Yeah. They wear tracksuits and they're like, oh, so like an Italian, but you're like, no, nothing like that. They have very distinct, youth bubbles of culture that don't really bleed into other countries.
Oh, yeah.
So.
The English youth are just constantly inventing. Like, what can we invent this week that's
thing? I remember on, have you ever seen the show The Inbetweeners?
Yeah.
British sitcom? I remember watching that and laughing my ass off just at the fact that they were doing like these short nubby ties, like those ties that would come like down to here.
Yeah, when we were at school, it was hilarious. So we all had to wear proper school uniform,
right,
which is actually better than trying to compete fashionable.
Absolutely.
So what the kids would do is they would try and work the margins of anything they could to just be not
to just be different.
Yeah. So like. Like kids would put like white socks on. Like I say, so I'm from near Coventry.
Okay.
So when Scar and Two Tone came around,
yep,
that was massive in mm-hmm. my town. So it was Coventry's right there. So there would be kids wearing like Fred Perry shirts, and the teachers would be like, "That's not a shirt. Get it changed." Trying to sneak whatever they could. And one of the things was like, you either had a massive kipper tie that was like a cravat. You had like this stubby thing. And it was just like a thing of like, I'm wearing the tie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or the other one was to put the big kipper bit inside your shirt and have it like bootlace.
Not the really
thin piece.
Yeah.
And do one of those two things. I was like on the lowest rung of nerddom.
Okay.
So my tie was always like a tightly bound knot because every fucking 10 minutes some bastard would go like that. And you'd spend half of the day trying to untie your tie sort of thing.
Did you ever, my dad always talks about getting the stick. Did you ever get the stick in school?
Oh yeah, we had I'll try and work my dad back
okay.
into this. So
we had
this, not the headmaster, the deputy headmaster was the most sadistic bastard you've ever met. And he was terrifying. Like, even the hard kids, you know, the ones that, like, came from real hard scrabble backgrounds mm-hmm. were terrified of the guy.
Wow.
And he would grab your earlobe and just drag you across the playground. Your fucking earlobe's mm-hmm. getting, like, 6 foot long. And then...
it's like those kids with those gauges now. Like, that
would be a fast track
to get it.
He must have invented them.
Yeah.
Right? And he would literally do that. People were fucking terrified of the guy. And when he got the cane, you didn't fucking sit down for like 3 days. So, like, you didn't want the cane,
uh-huh.
right? And one day we got caught doing something. It was something ridiculous. Some bullshit game we'd invented. And so he pulls us all into the office and we're like, oh, here comes the violence. You know
uh-huh.
what I mean? And he gave us this option and he goes, here's the thing, right? You can either have the cane right now or you can stand on the stage in the dining room the whole dinner time. The whole school is going to file by you and you're going to stand there like some, you know, weird like witch burning thing.
Oh, okay.
Right. So we're all like, that's the one for us.
Yeah,
we
don't want to get caned.
Well, I don't want my ass to be burning, right? So we go up on the stage. So next day he goes, right, you lot, you meet me right at the start of dinner time and you're going on the stage. And we're like, oh, this is a piece of piss.
Yeah,
you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
So he goes, here's the thing. I'm going to have the dinner monitor stand here. And if you guys even crack a smile this whole time you're on this stage, you're going to get caned as well.
Oh, so you've got to like those like the the British guards. You got to be like one of those dudes, yeah. Like not crack a smile, totally straight face.
Yeah,
I like
so,
that.
So if he see, so the denim monitor is going to be standing there. If you so much as crack a fucking smile, I own you for like the next 3 weeks. That you're going to get a cane.
Very sadistic.
Yeah. So he played us. You know what I mean? Like this, like played us into an.
He
even
enjoyed
worse.
Hitting kids with a stick.
Yeah, basically. And so me and my two mates are on the stage, and we're standing there, and of course. You imagine what it's like with like 500 British school kids.
Yeah.
We've got like erasers and shit just bouncing off our heads the whole time.
My God.
Yeah. Everyone's just screaming, like hurling abuse at you. And you're like, you can't even
That's
look
medieval.
Up.
That reminds me it of is. Like medieval when they got the guy like in the, yeah. what are those called? With the head and the hands yeah, all yeah. trapped. Yeah. And they're just throwing tomatoes at him.
Yeah. And the class clown ran up on stage and stood next to me and he's like clowning around. Oh, and yeah. I'm just standing. In there, like, yeah, the Coldstream guards, yeah. like, thousand yards stare, and all this stuff. That's what this
nobody
guy was,
broke, though. You guys,
nobody broke.
Wow,
you know,
that is real fear. Then,
I mean, I just came back and I had like welts where people had been throwing shit at me, like, it was like medieval, like you say. And then, anyway, let's bring my dad into this mm-hmm. story. So, cut to about 10 years later. And I hear a knock at the door, and I'm like, oh, fuck, I'm not answering that. My dad goes and answers the door, and I hear him talking to someone, and it's the guy, it's the sadist, and he's telling my dad, he's telling my dad he's running to be on the town council.
Oh, right? Wow.
And he said, you know, I don't know if you remember me, but, like, I was deputy head at Hastings High School. Maybe your kids went there, blah, blah, blah.
Hungry for power.
Yeah, and so he's retired, and he's going to run for the council. So my dad comes back in. And I go, were you talking to Mr. Goodman? And he goes, yeah, his name's Goodman. I go, oh, he was the deputy head when I was at Hastings. He was a total sadistic fucking maniac
yeah.
who ruled by terror. And my dad goes, well, he's got my vote then. and then he voted for him to be on the council just on the basis
that
this guy had like held generations of kids in abject terror.
That's my man. Yeah, yes. That's how you keep them in line right
there. That's what we need for the town council.
So how did you end up creating the Lincoln Lodge?
It was kind of like a need. So I'm an old bastard, right? We were around like 23 years. So when I first came to Chicago, I wrote for a couple of humorous pieces
okay.
that got published in magazines in England. But that was like nothing. That was like everyone did that. And then I came to Chicago.
In the 90s, that was kind of like a Facebook post getting published
yeah.
in a magazine.
In England, there was tons of them.
Tons of them, yeah.
Not that hard to get in. And then I came to America in about 96, and I just work in IT.
Okay.
So IT people in America in particular are staggeringly boring. Oh, shit. Now I can't promote this to my workers. But it's very boring, sterile environment.
Yeah.
So it's very easy to be the class clown, which is sort of what I became a little bit. And so a couple of people said to me, oh, you know, you should be a comedian or whatever. You've got the zingers and that. And I didn't really think much of it. And then, funnily enough, I was in Barnes & Noble one day and I saw the Judy Carter book. You know,
okay.
the infamous Judy Carter
yes.
book. And I thought, I'll
have a copy of that too.
I bought it. I was like, screw it, let's see what we do. And no, you know, so I read it all and despite what people say about Judy Carter and her book and everything, there's a lot of like good, solid advice
yeah,
in there.
That no comedian is smart enough to iterate to you. They'll just say, you know, I've heard the same advice come from comedians that's in that book, but it's just said not as well put and not as straightforward and half drunk kind of, you know?
Yeah. I'm not saying it's a be-all and end-all. I'm saying it
absolutely
adds
not.
Some stuff. You know what I mean? So the book says you need to find open mics. So I start trying to find open mics. Well, Chicago comedians, I hate to sound like an old bastard, but would not believe what Chicago was like at that time, right? There was Zanies. That was fucking it. That was a lot. I mean, maybe there was something in the burbs, but who's going there, right?
Yeah.
You weren't going to get booked at Zanies if you were from Chicago, for sure. The features and headliners were either old school Chicago or they were out of town. There was about 3 open mics on the north side. That was your lot. Maybe one on Monday, one on Wednesday, and there used to be one on Saturday, and that was your fucking lot.
Now there's 3 a night here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then there was maybe a couple of showcases kicking around that were even worth looking at. That was it. So I started, open micing, and then I thought, well, I used to go to a place called the Red Lion on Lincoln, and that was that. I thought, oh, I could put an open mic here. So I started an open mic. Then the lad who actually concepted the Lincoln Lodge approached me. He'd found the back of the diner at the Lincoln restaurant, and he said, this place would be awesome, because he was very like me, kind of very like visually oriented, like screw the black box nonsense, right? You know, that's so boring. Like, and he found this spot, so he approached me. He was good at promo marketing, I was good at building shit.
Yeah,
so that's how the Lincoln Lodge started. Was ever need before the Lincoln Lodge on the north side, there'd been 2 rooms worth pursuing that I when I was here, and that was one called The Elevated, which kind of invented a lot of the elements that we took. And that was like a back of a pool hall. Okay. But they were doing a lot of things that we would later incorporate into the Lincoln Lodge. And then the second room was The Elevated, which was at... The first room was The Elevated. The second room was Midnight Bible School, which was like...
That sounds fun.
It was at the Skybox in Second City.
Oh, nice.
And what actually happened is I'd been running an open mic that was generating a hell of a lot of great talent. Like people like Kyle Kinane and were going up there the time. And so a mate of mine, Matt, who ran Midnight Bible School, took a lot of the best open mic comedians who really didn't have an outlet at all, and built Bible School upon that, the back of that. And it became, actually, if you can find it, the first review of that was by the Chicago Tribune guy who was totally in the pocket of Zanies. And he just flayed it to death. But luckily it was at Second City, so they had the resource to just keep sending crowds to it. Like, it wasn't like a typical struggling alt room where we used to have to hand out flyers in Belmont L Stop in -20 degrees and shit. You know, all that. This had Second City behind it, so they didn't have to worry about a crowd.
That
they
is
just
nice.
Had to worry about the show.
Right. As long as you make people laugh, they'll come back. That's all you need to do.
But when the lodge started, there was nothing. So we took elements of these different 2 rooms that had preceded us and tried to unconsciously incorporate them into the lodge.
Okay.
And then the lodge became I would call now the de facto Chicago alt room model, which is to have a cast that you're invested in, like that are going to produce it and do everything. So a lot of these things that you were seeing, like, you know, the Tribune really effed us over in a lot of ways, the indie scene. First of all, they flayed alive anything that wasn't Zanies because they were in the pocket of. But the second thing they did is we had this burgeoning scene that was amazing, and the Lodge was flying at this point. And all the sort of copies of the Lodge, things like Underground and all that, started springing up. But all using the model, the key model, right?
Yeah.
And the Tribune did some article which basically they wanted to paint independent comedy shows as someone standing on an orange crate talking through a guitar amp. And someone conveniently gave them that.
Yeah.
To focus on.
Oh, okay.
And so that's what they inevitably did. But at the time, there were a lot of like well-produced shows going.
Yeah.
That was either in progress or starting up.
Well, that's obvious now because look at it now. It's blossomed into like a beautiful place with how many showrooms?
Well, this has 3 showrooms.
Three,
but talking about volume, you know, prior to the COVID incident, there's how many guys, you know, there was like 27 open mics a night, five right. showcase rooms. I mean, that to an old bastard like me was unfathomable when we first started out.
I mean, it's incredible what you've done, and I love the Lincoln Lodge, and thank you so much for creating it. Is there anything else you want to plug before we head out?
Oh, are we going to talk about my dad?
Oh, well, we did touch on him. Do you have a quick story you want to share before we head out about your dad in particular?
No, I was expecting all like a dad grilling. I'm sorry.
I got so fascinated by the motorcycle part. I really ran with that.
I was trying to work him in there. No, I'm fine. I mean, so I had a because you'd wanted to talk to me about what are English dads like. Right?
I do. That was the thing. Because I had an English dad in America, so I feel like I had a different experience. Because it wasn't foreign enough to be like in with the other immigrant family kids, you know? They'd be like, oh, you're an American. And it was still weird enough to not be an American, you know, because I don't watch football really. Yeah. And like I eat Yorkshire puddings and they're like, what the fuck is that? We watch cricket and my dad bets a lot, you know? So I wanted to know what it was like to have a British dad in Britain. I mean,
Well, I had a very, very non-typical upbringing. So, okay. Basically, I didn't have a mum is the way to I always put it.
Okay.
When my mum left the family unit, she didn't die, she just up and left.
Okay.
And so my dad raised me and my sister on his own.
Wow.
From like I was age four, my sister was like two. So it's hard for me to go, well, what is a typical family dynamic? Yeah. Because we had a whole piece of ours flat out missing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad was always this really weird mix of like he was kind of a hard ass because he had to be to make it through life. You know, like I say, we weren't very wealthy, that's for sure. So, like, and he was trying to raise two kids on his own. But on the other hand, what I could see coming from my grandma was this guy who was like, do anything to help you. So he basically kind of sacrificed his life for us, lumbered with two kids from, you know, basically age, I was four, my sister was two. So he was this really weird sort of mix of a person where he could like absolutely be busting your ass and be really hard ass about something. But you always knew that like everything he did was just geared to like raising you. You know, he'd sacrificed pretty much everything just to be in that situation. So I guess I'm the worst interviewer because I honestly can't say that I was raised in a typical way. Like this was in the early 70s. So like now you say someone's divorced, it's like, well, yeah, who the fuck is it?
Yeah,
you know what
I
mean?
But back then
it was a huge thing. I remember being like extremely upset to be the only kid with a single parent in my entire like class and year almost.
Oh wow.
You know what I mean? It was that odd at that time.
I know my dad's parents also got divorced, I think, when they were like around, because he was a twin. He is a fraternal twin. And I think they were like 10 or something when that happened. And I think it was also like, it was just a huge deal because again, it was in the 70s.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen a lot. So with the motorcycle racing, I feel like were you not like a mischievous kid? Like, did you get any trouble, like big trouble with him besides the car incident we talked about?
No. So there was as a kid, I have had two different lives.
Okay.
I had my pre-America life and my America life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, the breakup of my, the parent thing was extremely traumatic to me because what actually happened was so my mom did a bunk with another guy and took me with them but left my sister. And so I had a year of my life where I never saw my dad and my sister. We were living on like this weird like gypsy site in Wales, believe it or not. And when I came back, the whole trauma of it, because it's like your life is suddenly gone and then back again. And you're age four. It's like a bit intense.
Right.
So I was like, people won't believe this now, but I was crippled with shyness and like a lack of self-confidence from a very early age, because when you do that to a kid, it kind of shakes them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They just hide in their shell for a while.
You just really don't know what life... So for me, from age four to like 25, 26, I couldn't talk to... I mean, women were just a total mystery because I'd never had...
You just have your dad just being like, I don't know either.
Well, I had my sister, but she fucking hated me. So there wasn't a lot of like I could do with that. So for most of my life, I was too terrified to talk to women, and I was very in my shell about things.
Yeah.
Because presumably it backtracks to that. I really do try not to blame parents for things. That's what I noticed when I came to America, is everyone's blaming their parents. Oh, my dad's this, my mom's this.
100%.
In England, you do not blame your parents for shit. It's like, this was the hand you're dealt.
That's why he hates the podcast.
Is it?
I don't know.
I mean, in England, it's like, this is the hand you're dealt. Suck it up and play that hand.
Right.
Whereas in America, it's a bit more touchy-feely. Like, you're this way because this happened to you.
Yeah.
And here's a weighted blanket. Climb under your weighted blanket and stay there. Whereas in England, you would just get your ass kicked. Like, no, pull your fucking... Get on with it.
Right.
That's what
you would think would be an American ideal, but it just isn't. No one wants to feel at fault for being a jackass. You know what I mean? Whenever I get mad, it's that American thing. Whenever I show that rage or whatever, like I never get mad at humans. It's always objects like vacuums or like windows or like shit that doesn't work when it's supposed to. I lose my computer mice.
Yeah.
I go, oh, that's just my dad. You know, I just shake it off like that. I can see, whereas, like, I should be like, no, that's me, and I should work on it. I go, no, that's because of him, because he yelled at me when I spilled milk and stuff. We used to, when my dad was coming home, me and my sister would literally do, like, you'd think the Nazis were coming to look at for banned books, because we were like, we gotta put this away, Ah, that's on the we had to, like, comb the carpet and shit. Yeah. He's very particular.
What people, like, a lot of Americans think England is, like, you know, Hogwarts and
bullshit. It's hilarious.
It's economically, it's a way poorer country than America.
It's gritty.
And it's gritty, it's working class, and it's hard. And that breeds, like, hard people, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of why you see, you know...
But fucking great TV, though.
good TV and music, but horrible fucking people. and it makes people, you know, when you get that, it makes people hard. You know what I mean? Like, I had friends at school, and their dads never even talked. You could be in the room. Yeah. You could be in the room for like 10 minutes and they wouldn't even acknowledge you. You know what I mean? Like, that's how the work, like, you know, the town I grew up in, there was no middle class in that town. There was the factory owners,
and then there was
everyone else.
Right.
And so, you know, you went into a factory at age 15 or 16, or like my dad was 15 when he went into a factory, and then it spits you out at 65.
Going,
well, that was fucking it. That's my lot played, you know what I mean?
Right, there's your last check. Have a good one.
Yeah, and that breeds a hardness in
people. Did your dad work in a factory?
Yeah, he worked his entire life basically in a dry cleaning factory.
Oh, really? I would have guessed car factory.
No, the town I'm from was all knitwear and garments.
Okay,
so everything revolved around making clothes and stuff.
Now, Mark, do you have a podcast on the network?
I do, but it's kind of parked right now, but hopefully it'll be back soon.
Yeah, because we're going to get the new studio. What's the name of your podcast?
Mine's called You Think That's Funny, where break down sort of what people find funny and why. It is a little bit of a psychology experiment, but
there we go.
It's a good thing just to sort of see, you know, there's always a pleasant surprise in there where it's like, oh, you find that funny kind of thing.
And I do like talking about comedy and jokes like that. It's always fun to break down why if you say a joke like this, it kind of misses, but if you use, you know, if you put this part here and this part there, then it works. I that part's fascinating to me because it's like mental magic, you know?
Yeah. Well, the podcast I'm running, we try and get cokes out of people, not just sort of like, oh, I like TV, you know, I like Family Guy.
Yeah.
We're looking for stuff that's actually like, you know what? Every time I see a skateboarder wipe out, I lose my shit off.
Something,
everyone has different things that they can recall. Like, I remember my mate tripped over a kid in the hallway in school one time, and I can still, it's burned into my brain now.
I like falls. Falls are good for me. I'm a huge, now that you said that though, I will laugh every time if somebody's doing something stupid and there's somebody else looking disgusted at them, that gets me every time.
That's my cat.
Yeah.
One cat doing something stupid exactly. And the other looking at it like,
what the fuck are you doing? I don't know what it is about that. It's that, like, I relate to that, whatever you're looking at him, like the judgment, all of it. It makes me laugh, so well, that's funny.
My dirty little comedy secret is prank phone calls and pranks.
Oh, I goddamn love prank phone calls. Jesus. Two Chinese restaurants talking to each other.
Yeah.
And I could watch that for 2.5 hours.
Yeah. The last time I cried with tears was a Jerky Boys
yes,
album, You know what I mean? And then, did you ever watch Trigger Happy TV with Dom Jolly?
Trigger Happy TV.
It's a prank TV thing, but it's on another like surreal, bizarre level.
Oh, I don't think so.
Yeah, he had one famous one where like a guy was walking around dressed as a snail. He walks up to the
yes, I have seen that
thing,
and then
when the car stops, he like crawls.
Yes,
past, like,
yes.
It was more thought out.
Was that the guy who dressed as the devil sometimes? Did they have that sketch?
He's like a fairly chubby guy with big glasses.
Oh, okay.
Jolly, his name
I've seen the snail thing. That might have just been like a YouTube clip or something that I stumbled upon. Balls of Steel is what I used to watch. You ever watch Balls of Steel? I think that was a British prank TV show, too.
Oh, is that the Welsh ones?
It could be Welsh, yeah.
I don't know if it was called that. I thought it was called something else, but I know there was a Welsh one that was like even worse than Jackass for like physical pain and like,
oh, it wasn't that. It was just like a dude in a cowboy hat would order McNuggets at a mall and then just like push the security guard over and like run out the door kind of thing. And he had a cowboy hat on.
I don't remember that one because
I might have dreamed it.
The guy, you remember, do you watch the vampire thing, What We Do in the Shadows?
I'm about to start it.
Okay, so the guy who's mainly in that, Kayvan Novak, is
correct.
Name.
Yes, he was in IT Crowd.
I hate that one, so I'm watching.
I'm
got
sure you
so
do.
So many comedy heroes.
I'm sure you do.
You know, Richard Ayoade and Matt Berry, and it's like, what the fuck are they doing in a sitcom? But anyway, Kayvan Novak was in did two things. He started off as Phone Jacker, and then they made a TV thing called Face Jacker, and he's in that.
Well, Mark, this was super fun. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Cheers. Come on down to Lincoln Lodge. Hey guys, you just listened to another episode of Fuck You Dad. If you could follow us on our Instagram, which is FCKYOUDAD podcast. That's the important one. We also have a Twitter account, which is FCKYOUDADPODCA1. If you could follow that. Also, please submit any father stories that you have that you'd like us to make fun of, laugh at, or share. Shoot that to our Instagram DMs. And if you could please go ahead and rate the podcast, share the podcast with your friends and family that might enjoy it. And keep listening. Thank you so much.